9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Live from London, this is The Morning Break with Emma Shepherd on Teachers Talk Radio.
Good morning, it's Emma Shepherd with your Morning Break on Teachers Talk Radio, every Tuesday between 9 to 10 a.m. This morning we're talking to our guests, from forest school leaders to museum staff, about their wide-ranging experiences of learning outside the classroom. Do you comment on social media, message in your thoughts via the chat on the Podbean app, or call in to share your own experiences of learning outside the classroom.
Live from London, this is The Morning Break with Emma Shepherd on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/ttradio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio.
Good morning on what seems to be a very windy day. Or windy morning for everybody in the country. What a bit of a storm that we had last night and yesterday afternoon. So a little bit ironic that we are talking about learning outside the classroom this morning on the Morning Break in weather that maybe many of us wouldn't actually want to be outside in. And I know as an English teacher, I'm fairly classroom based. My favourite place, a bit like a cat on a day like today, would be curled up in the library on a comfortable armchair. Reading a book rather than getting out and about. But I tell you what, since I have been on maternity leave, I've always been a bit, I like being outside. I don't like the wet, I don't like the rain, and I'm not particularly great with the cold. I'm not great with the hot either, actually. So maybe I'm just imagining how good I am outside. But since I've been on maternity leave, I really did enjoy getting out and about to museums with my children, strapped to me or in buggies. Going to country homes, my husband and I took the opportunity to go up to the Peak District outside of term time on my first maternity leave, and I pranced around with my sort of Wuthering Heights, Jane Austen, just general outside 19th century fantasies, standing on rocks like Elizabeth Bennet did in the Keira Knightley version. We've got a campaign as the MTPT project to encourage any members of our community to do exactly that with their new babies, to get out into the outdoors, learn from outdoor environments with our Walk for CPD hashtag. So if you're looking for local walks or local places of interest outside whilst you're on mat leave, or for your weekends or for your holidays or your days where you don't work in school, then do check out Walk for CPD, the hashtag. To get some recommendations for your area. Now, there's obviously more to learning outside the classroom than just fresh air. And our guests are going to be telling us a little bit more about the pedagogy and some of the research behind it today. And if you are interested, I've pinned a tweet to the @maternitycpd handle, because when I started prepping for this show, feeling a little bit like an imposter, the bookish person that I am, I found some reports that are really quite interesting in terms of writing up on why these things, or reading up on why these things are important. So in 2006, the DfE produced a Learning Outside the Classroom manifesto, and it talked about the most memorable learning being that which happens outside the classroom, and encouraging schools to explore a variety of locations. So concert halls, field trips, their own grounds, their local communities, to transfer the experience from the classroom to their communities and make sure that they are putting their learning in the context of real life. And that report actually talks about learning outside the classroom as a vehicle to develop the capacity to learn. So as well as the knowledge that we get from these outside spaces, actually the skills that they develop. And there was a 2008 Ofsted report as well called Learning Outside the Classroom, creatively. How far should you go? And it researched the effectiveness of learning outside the classroom across a number of schools, highlighting the importance of this approach being central to the curriculum, so rather than an add-on. And I know that a number of our guests are going to be talking quite passionately about that today. But it also highlighted how important learning outside the classroom is to the emotional well-being and development of young people, and the skills and the soft skills that it develops. So today on the show, our guests are going to explain how they engage with outdoor learning in their different primary, secondary, and further education settings. We're going to hear from teachers in the classroom, or outside of it in this case, but also staff working in museum education to think about how we are making the connection between our learning spaces at school and the learning spaces in our communities. So our first guest that we're going to hear from today, if she is ready to call in, is Sarah Watkins. She is a reception teacher and a forest school leader, and she writes regularly for TeachWire and has a book on outdoor play coming out in September, which she can tell us a little bit about as well. So good morning, Sarah. How are you this morning?
Good morning. Can you hear me?
And you are loud and clear, yep.
Oh, fantastic. I wasn't sure this would work.
Getting up to date with technology. We've all been on a bit of a learning journey with the tech, haven't we, this year?
So absolutely.
Tell us, Sarah, a little bit about yourself, including a little bit of information us about your book that's coming out in September.
Yeah, sure. So I've taught every year group at primary school. I was a head of school. At the moment, I'm a reception teacher. And as you said, I've just written my first book for Routledge. And it's part of this fantastic new series aimed at early years teachers called Little Minds Matter. So every book in the series is about working to improve young children's mental health. And I was really lucky to be given the title Outdoor Play. So looking at outdoor play for mental health of children. So it was a fantastic project to work on. Really, really enjoyed it.
And that sounds, I love that little little Minds Matter they do. It's made me smile this morning. And so we look forward to grabbing that when it's out in September. But the reason, part of the reason you are a specialist sort of able to write a book at this is because you, you're a forest school leader. So for those of us who don't know, and I know only know a little bit sort of what I see in nursery and what I've explored for my own children as a mum, but tell us a little bit more about the forest school setup and the forest school principles.
Yeah, absolutely. So forest school is quite a specific ethos. I think people sometimes misunderstand it. And on the Forest School Association website, they do set out some myths they've come across, including if you're outdoors regularly, that doesn't mean it's forest school. But the forest school setup needs to be quite closely aligned to the forest school principles. So this is a set of guidance that was agreed by the Forest School Association in 2014. So quite recent in some ways. And I think these principles, you know, really should be guidance for how you set up forest school and how you run it. And you can find these on the Forest School Association website. And the first principle is that children must visit the site regularly, otherwise it's not forest school. So ideally you need access to a site, whether it's on your school site or somewhere nearby where children can visit on a regular basis. I know that's not always easy, especially if you're an urban school, but I found in previous schools I've worked in that you can actually have a forest school site in a very small area. The second principle is that it must take place in a woodland, but the Forest School Association point out that it can just be a few trees. It doesn't have to be a full-blown forest or woodland. In my NQT year, I worked at a school that was a new-build school. So the field, it was a fantastic site, but the field was simply that. It was just grass, no shrubs, no trees, nothing. So in the long term, we had to plant trees and let the area rewild. So encourage nettles, brambles, shrubs and bushes. And in the short term, as a forest school leader, I had to bring in materials like logs and so on just to create those natural obstacles and make it seem a little bit more like a forest school. And it was amazing, actually, how quickly it became a forest school area. And then the third principle is it must support the holistic development of children. They must be in charge of their learning, have fun, get dirty, take risks, use tools. I think the getting dirty part is really important. So you need access to a space where children can get muddy, really get down in the dirt. And it's been shown, research has shown that mud actually makes people happier if you're getting hands on in it. So scientists have studied it and they've shown that there's microbes in there which increase serotonin. So it's really good for your happiness. So you need that sort of space. You also need, the fourth principle is opportunities to take risks. So I think most people would associate forest school with fire and tools. And that's a really important part of a forest school, to have access to tools and the means to make fire, obviously under close supervision. The fifth principle is it must be run by qualified practitioners. You must have a forest school certificate and you should have a good ratio, so small groups. And the last principle is that it must be learner-centred. So it's not about going out to a site and saying, right, children, this is what we're going to do. We're going to do A, B, C, and you'll follow my rules. It's actually about observing the children, seeing what they're doing, following their lead, and maybe extending that learning. So I think if you're setting up a site, it needs to be very closely aligned to those principles.
Sounds almost sort of Montessori in that way, in terms of observing the children and following the children. And I think
definitely
something that struck me there, that importance of trees. My husband is, he's into sustainability, so he loves nature. He's obsessed with trees, and he's always talking to me about how important they are to the overall environment. So I suppose there's that connection there of those forest schools being good for the overall environment, the habitats, the birds, the insects, the soil, that sort of thing. So it's quite fascinating just hearing that, the impact on the environment that simply setting up a forest school must have.
Sustainability is a key part of forest school. It is mentioned in the Forest School Association's ethos, you know, that's part of our role as forest school leaders, to encourage children to take care of the earth. Yeah. Mm.
And so what do you think the benefits of forest school are, both for the students, but also the staff who are running these? Because, I mean, if I'm honest, yes, my children love mud, but we have a little park opposite where there's a forest school, and I see them sitting around in a tent, and I just think, oh God, how miserable I've been on those walks where everybody's wet and cold and dirty, and I know I'm going to be responsible for getting them in the house without destroying the wallpaper. So what can you sell us? What are the benefits for everybody involved?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think for the staff, Sarah, another Sarah that works with me, she's a TA at my school, and we both run forest school together. So she's forest school trained. And we were stood in our forest school area the other day, so we take them out weekly. And we just took a breath of fresh air and said, you know, we can't believe we're getting paid for this. It was so amazing, so rewarding. And I have to say, we love going out in any weather. It doesn't suit everybody. But I think if you've got the right clothing, you know, you feel comfortable. But it's just such a joyous experience, really. I mean, it really improves your own mental health, being out there in the fresh air. And I think bad weather always looks worse through a window. That's the saying, isn't it? Once you're out there, it's not so bad. And you get to see students in a completely different context. You build stronger relationships with them because you've got a smaller group, but you're also taking a lead from them. You're giving them responsibility. You're giving them trust. And you see them blossom, and you see them try things that they wouldn't necessarily try. So for our less confident students, especially those who are perhaps not so academically minded, you see them really grow and develop out in the forest school area. And that's just amazing to see. And getting outdoors, and especially in the forest school area, it's really good for physical and mental health. The children build their physical skills, they develop their gross and motor skills. The tree climbing is fantastic for developing their physical skills, but also their resilience and their confidence. And nature connectedness has been shown to improve mental health and make children happier. So, and I think we've lost that, not just during the pandemic, but before the pandemic. The statistics were quite scary about how little time children were getting outdoors. Some research has shown it's less time than people in maximum security jails that young children are getting outdoors. So it's really important, but also it's fantastic for STEM learning. You see that amazing collaboration on self-directed projects. So, you know, just den building or building bridges and so on. They're working together, building that socialisation and empathy. So, yes, I'm a huge fan.
And I suppose even, I mean, I work in a London school and I live in London, and I'm constantly hunting for outdoor time because I do love being outdoors as long as not raining. I'm not a fan of the rain. But just even being on duty during the school day and being able to stand in the fresh air, it just gives you that mind space, doesn't it, to just get out of the of the sort of busyness of the four walls, and
absolutely,
just refresh a little bit. So when I was reading this 2008 Ofsted report, one thing that it pulled out was that the primaries that they had explored were much better at outdoor learning generally. So not specifically forest school learning, but outdoor learning, and much better at using their grounds and local areas than secondary schools. So you're working in reception at the minute, is that correct? Or year one, did you say?
Yes, that's right. Yes, reception.
And so how do you see the benefits of the forest school principles for your reception children build up through the skill, through the school, as they sort of go up into key stage one and key stage two?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've taught year six, so I've sort of taught the whole age group. So it's nice to see, I have changed schools quite a lot, so I haven't really managed to see the same children progressing. But they start to build a real relationship with the site and have that increased ownership over it. And I think for year six, for example, it's even more important because there's so much more academic pressure on them, even at that level. And they really need that time to sort of build their mental health, be outdoors, and focus on something else. And it's been shown that having that time outdoors helps concentration, and helps mental health, and that helps your academic performance as well. But older children start to be able to maintain the area and the resources. And I think the increased passive learning where children are sat down more of the time just means they need much more active exploration outside. And the older children can start to carry out bigger experiments, bigger constructions. And you see those changing relationships and dynamics and children taking bigger appropriate risks, which is fantastic.
And risk-taking is a really big part of the Forest School principles as well, I was reading on the website. So thank you so much, Sarah, for joining us today and sharing
thank
all that
you.
Information with us. I know you've got to rush off now, and good luck with your son. He's got an exam this morning. Is he older?
It's
older
an
boy?
English exam, yes, oh. English exam at sixth form.
best of luck to him. Well done for such a,
thank
such
you.
A difficult year, and well done you for supporting him through that. So have a lovely
thank you very much for having me. Thank you. Bye.
So a great start from Sarah there, telling us all about the Forest School principles. And as I said, it's something that I've researched a little bit for my own children, but my absolute favourite is seeing it in action. So we live near a number of green spaces, even though we do live fairly centrally in London. And it's really just really heartwarming. It sort of restores your faith in humanity to see sort of 10, 12 little children sitting under a lean-to or the twig-built tents with their snacks and with their drinks and around a campfire and doing their learning around that natural space and having that environment to learn in and just being told, you know, being dirty doesn't matter and they've got that wildness and that freedom that especially at 2, 3, 4 and 5, that's so important, and it also tires them out quite nicely, I imagine, for bedtime. So if you are interested in either setting up a Forest School in your own primary setting, then the Forest School Association website is really helpful for that. But as we heard from Sarah there, and as the website will tell you, you do need a Forest School trained practitioner within your workforce. And I imagine that across primaries and secondaries, there are people who will be absolutely delighted to take that on as a piece of professional development. And Twitter as well, the Forest Schools Association are on Twitter. There's also quite a thriving community on Twitter who share pictures of their setting and share activities they do in their setting to make sure that the national curriculum is being covered within that Forest School environment. So if you are joining us on the chat today, then please do comment on anything that you are hearing, ask any questions that we might be able to share with our next guests throughout the show. Or if you're listening later on Spotify or the Podbean or another podcast platform, then we'd love to hear your thoughts on Twitter. We've got a hashtag TT Radio that we use for all our Teacher Talk radio shows. And you can tag in at TT Radio 2021. Or my hashtag that I use for the radio show is at MaternityCPD. And there's a whole thread, as I mentioned at the start of the show, on some of the reports that I read before the show and that we've been hearing about a little bit today. So if it is something that interests you as an academic study or as a sort of professional development study or for your own children to learn a little bit more about the childcare provision that you could be offering them, then please do have a look at that pinned tweet. Now, our next guest this morning, we're going right up the age range, all the way to further education, so post-16 education. And we're going to be hearing from Glenda, who is a teaching and learning and PGCE mentor. And she's also a sports psychologist and the lead of the Level 3 course on outdoor learning in her further education setting in Wales. So good morning, Glenda. How are you this morning?
Good morning. Yes, really good. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And I was just thinking, what a fantastic country to be leading on an outdoor education course on. Wales has got everything that you could possibly want in terms of outdoor spaces, isn't it?
Oh my goodness, that is so true. I mean, I don't want to make everybody jealous, but in the college that I teach at, my desk looks right out onto the estuary and the Gower Peninsula. And it's absolutely glorious.
Oh, wow.
As you say,
are you right sort of by three cliffs? Is that where you are?
We actually look on to sort of Llanmadog and Worms Head. So we're on the other side of the estuary from there. Yeah, three cliffs. What an amazing place. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's an amazing area of the country. I've got a friend who lives sort of Swansea way, and every time we visit, we do a big walk around the Three Cliffs. So maybe I'll ask her to take me a little bit further by you next time so we can explore something a bit new. So Glenda, tell us a little bit about your role and the outdoor education course that you lead in your college.
Okay, so the outdoor education course I lead is level 3. It's a BTEC qualification, and it's an extended diploma. And within that course, our students work towards industry standard qualifications, and they do modules such as leadership and equipment and psychology. And we also teach them the basics and the fundamentals of water-based and land-based activities. So in any one given week, we would have time in the classroom, and we will have time outside in the physical environment, whether that be in the mountains, in the forest, on the water. So each week is very different.
I'm just going to pause for a tech comment, Glenda. I don't know if there's anywhere else that you can stand in your room that might give you a slightly stronger signal, because we're sort of,
sure.
you're right in the countryside. You're jumping in and out a little bit.
Okay. Let me have a look.
we'll see if you can find the sweet spot with your Wi-Fi. But it sounds a little bit like it has crossovers with some of the stuff we do lower down in secondary, so Duke of Edinburgh or expedition work, or some of the sort of NCFE sports coaching awards. Does it have crossovers with anything like that at all? Or am I barking up the wrong tree there?
No, 100% it does have a crossover. So the qualification is actually a very similar to a sport qualification or a fitness qualification, but obviously the modules are geared towards the outdoor. Within it as well, we have modules for expeditions. So it aligns really nicely with the DOD program. So no, you're not 100 miles away at all. It's very, very close to it.
And so when you've got your students that complete your course with you, so they're 16 to 18, are they?
Well, they're not always 16 to 18. That is sort of the age group that everyone thinks of when they think of FE. But actually, it runs from like 16 up to, say, 23. We find some students have been doing the course, and then they think, actually, this isn't what I want to do. I don't want to work inside. I want to be outside. And then they come across my course, and it's a game changer for them.
Amazing. So really quite sort of a young adult cohort that you've got there.
Yes.
And so when they leave you from that course, what sort of employment or higher education do they go into?
Okay.
And why do you think that those roles are so important to our society that we're living in at the minute?
So my students go to a broad variety of different things. Some of them go on to PhD and they study outdoor activities at university. Some of them go to be instructors, and they go and work all over the world, whether it be instructing in places like Austria in the mountains, ski instructors. They go and work for DfE, whatever it may be. And lots of our students end up being self-employed, and actually some of the local providers that we use are our students. So it's really lovely to have that full circle. And why is it so important? Well, I could be here all day talking about this. I mean, as your previous guest was just talking about, you know, with the coronavirus this year, mental health is at an all-time low with our students. And within the course that we teach, it's giving them the opportunity to appreciate the outdoors and become really resilient and overcome adversity. So let me just give you an example. This week, I'm going to be taking my students caving. And because we've got a massive caving system in Wales that goes on for miles and miles and miles. So with caving, we call it second degree fun, a bit like a roller coaster. when you're on it, you're thinking, why on earth am I doing this? But afterwards, when you've got through it, there's this absolute surge of excitement, and it really brings you together as a group. So, I mean, you're getting...
I can imagine.
Yeah, you're getting these teamwork skills that are unlike any other. And then love of nature, leading others, being compassionate about others. Because, you know, going back to that caning example, you realise you can't do that on your own. You know, there will be a point where you will need either a little bit of a talk with one of your friends to help you through it, or you might physically need them to help you. So it's giving our students a real opportunity to work together and become natural problem solvers as well. I mean, and these skills, no matter what job you're going to do in any walk of life, they're just an asset, aren't they?
And I can imagine just the courage and the confidence that young people build. I mean, I know that when I was 18, I went on a world challenge expedition, and it was an incredible opportunity. Actually, we went to India and we climbed in the Himalayas, and we had to do all the fundraising and the fitness to do that. And I found it an incredible challenge. And actually, when we were doing our walk, we walked for 2 weeks. I don't think I enjoyed a single second of it because I found it so difficult. And actually, what I found most difficult was the emotional impact of the physicality and feeling like I couldn't do something. But having the sort of, because we were at altitude and I wasn't the most active teenager, I've since sorted myself out a little bit. But what really struck me sort of on reflection was how much my resilience needed to be developed in order to appreciate the most incredible things that I was seeing. And it's only now looking back on that opportunity that I can appreciate that for what it was. And it's a shame in many ways that I wasn't maybe mature enough to deal with that at the time. But since then, the ability to, I've sort of climbed in Peru, I've climbed in North Africa, climbed in Asia. And again, it's that mindset of getting through something, pausing, appreciating the beauty that's around you when something is really, really difficult. Absolutely understand how important it is to mental health, to resilience, and to some of those softer skills of getting on with things sometimes.
Yeah.
So you've got your older learners there, so your 16 plus and your sort of young 20s learners. But when you get students coming to you from secondary and maybe even thinking tracking all the way back to primary, what sort of things would you like to see a bit more of to prepare them for taking up a course like yours?
I think essentially I would just like to see more outdoor provision in schools. So your previous scholar there, you know, forest school, it's fantastic. It gives really young students opportunities to engage with the outdoors. And then that's something that often becomes very, very lost in secondary school. You know, I come from a secondary school background, a school that had a massive TV programme, but that's not the case in every school. So I'm finding that a lot of students don't even sort of acknowledge this opportunity to go on an outdoor course. It's, you know, it's not something that's on their radar. Whereas if they have experienced something, for example, like science, they think, oh, I really like science, I'm really good at it, and I really enjoy it, so I want to go and study that. But if they haven't had that opportunity to experience this at secondary school, then they don't know. And I think that's something that is becoming a sort of a bigger issue, because as soon as there's cuts, they tend to cut it from things like outdoor provision. So it would be very interesting actually to see how many students have experienced outdoor education in their secondary schools. So what I'd like to see is I'd like students to give them more, and not just to be, you know, 1 week at a local centre. I would love to see it as something that's embedded into the curriculum. And even if they just have
It's often left to the geography teachers and the PE teachers, isn't it? Or a sort of enthusiastic Duke of Edinburgh lead within the school somewhere to get children outside at secondary level.
I completely agree with you.
And actually, having worked in secondaries for my entire career, it's the risk assessment and the paperwork that often is very off-putting, and having to put things through the governors and get things approved and parental permission. There's so much red tape often in secondary. I don't know if it's the same in primary, I imagine it is, but for some reason that acts as such a blocker with everything else that we've got going on.
I think that's the case at every single level. I mean, the amount of paperwork and resource lessons that I have to do at the start of every year and my local providers do is quite onerous, actually. So I can imagine that if you're not doing this on a weekly basis, it takes up a lot of time. So if there was something within the school or within the college where people could help with that, that would be fantastic. But I also think giving...
It's always struck me as something that should be maybe awarded as a TLR, the TRIPS coordinator, somebody who just gets very good at doing the paperwork, and that people go to when they say, I want to organise this trip, I want this to happen, I want it for these students, and somebody who knows exactly what they're doing just whizzes through it rather than somebody new labouring through everything all the time. We want to do something new.
Absolutely, that's the case. It's the case not just for outdoor, it's the case for sport. If you want to take your students across the road, I mean, there's risk assessments galore that you've got to fill in. So if there's something that could be done to help that, that would be fantastic. I think the other thing is about giving staff confidence to do it. I mean, you don't have to be the geography teacher, you don't have to be the PE teacher to do this. You know, if you've got an interest or you've got a willingness to learn, if we can upskill staff so that they can spread the outdoor message, all the better for our students. You know, there's lots of different accreditations that they can work for, such as Forest School or NOLA programs or DOV programs. And it's surprising that in a school, when you open up, or in a petty college or whatever it may be, when you open up these opportunities, students are just on board and they look back in fondness in years to come, a bit like you do with your trip, about how maybe at the time you didn't enjoy it, but it's something that really resonates with you and stays with you forever.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning, Glenda, to talk about your course and to speak so passionately about outdoor education. I hope you have a lovely time looking at that view and get outside into your lovely peninsula this morning.
Lovely. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
So a little bit of a delay on the line there with Glenda, but I hope that you were able to hear everything that she was saying, talking so passionately about outdoor education. And I have to say that her course definitely does sound one not for the faint-hearted, or maybe for people who don't want to be faint-hearted any longer. It sounds very, very adventurous. So again, if you would like to learn more about the courses that Glenda was offering, she was talking about Level 3 in Outdoor Education. I had a quick Google search of it yesterday and got sucked down a bit of a rabbit hole in terms of looking at the images and the galleries of various colleges offering this course. And thinking about the different parts of the country where these courses take place and all the exciting careers that young people can go on to do once they have got these qualifications or developed an interest in outdoor learning and leading on outdoor education. So if you have any comments that you'd like to share in response to our guests this morning, then please do pop them in the Podbean app chat if you're listening to us live this morning. We've been hearing from teachers who have a specialism in learning outside the classroom with children from as young as reception age students in forest schools, all the way up to post-16 education. If you are listening later, then please do use the hashtag TTRadio and tag us in at TTRadio2021 to share your own experiences of learning outside the classroom or to ask any questions to our community if you are hoping to include more outdoor learning in your school as we open up a little bit following the coronavirus and the lockdown and the pandemic across the country. My personal handle is at maternitycpd, and I'm Emma Shepherd with the morning break on Teachers Talk Radio. It's now 9:33, and we will have a listen to the news. I've forgotten to wish you a happy May the 4th. May the 4th be with you today, everybody. Let's see what's going on in the news.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News with Megan Goods.
This is your latest Teachers Talk Radio News. A new report published in The Guardian suggests the Teaching Regulation Agency is being misused by schools unable to resolve teacher disciplinary cases within their own HR departments. The TRA has only one sanction to prohibit teachers from teaching, yet is often utilised for resolving cases lawyers quoted in the article felt should be dealt with in-house. One prevalent example is that of Alexander Price. Price was banned from teaching for 2 years by the TRA for writing an anonymous blog. The blog criticised his school, although it was never mentioned by name, and described female students as dressing like Eastern European prostitutes or transhuman Kardashian clones. An exclusive report from ITV on Hackney New School was released over the weekend and focused on what was referred to as the school's excessive discipline. Criticisms of the school in the report focused on the number of students in detention on a daily basis, the reference to students in detention as detainees, and a staff handbook that stated following the rules could be seen as feminine by male students. Four members of staff, both past and present, approached ITV with concerns over the impact of the school's disciplinary policies on students' mental health. The school has since issued a statement outlining their intent to go to Ofcom about the report, also calling the allegations unsubstantiated and the report itself neither balanced nor fair. What does the future of education look like to you? Teachers Talk Radio wants to hear your ideas as part of its latest competition. Simply submit a video presentation of up to 10 minutes outlining your thoughts to teacherstalkradio@gmail.com. The 5 selected winners will receive a prize of £50 and the opportunity to present at a high-profile education conference. More information can be found on the Teachers Talk Radio website. That was your daily education news briefing.
Thank you so much to our news. So this is the morning break. If you have just joined us live on Teachers Talk Radio, my name is Emma Shepherd, and we have been talking this morning to a number of guests about their experience of leading education learning outside the classroom. So we have heard from a forest school leader working with very young children. So we heard from Sarah Watkins this morning. And we also heard from Glenda Dowdell, who is working based over in Wales, leading an outdoor education course in a further education college. We are going to hear in a moment from our final guest of the show, who works in museum education. And I initially came into contact with Laura when I was on maternity leave with my second child, Lucy. And I had the good fortune of working with and networking with colleagues across 3 museums in London. I'm very spoilt to be living in London with the museums that we have on offer. And I explored the Imperial War Museum, the Museum of London and Strawberry Hill House, and was a little bit bolshy and introduced myself to their education leads there, which built some really beautiful partnerships, definitely for my own professional development. I was also able to chat to them from a curriculum perspective and from a secondary English teacher perspective, thinking about how their museums programmes and how some of their artefacts are being used for secondary education. Now, obviously, with the pandemic, the museums that we have cross-country have been detrimentally impacted by them. And I don't think that there have been any school visits going out to museums since last March. Laura might disagree with me there. But when they are back up and running, I cannot impress enough how wonderful they are as spaces to take students across all subjects to really get hands-on with artefacts, to take their learning from the textbook and from the videos and from the PowerPoints and actually see some of the artefacts that we talk about are so important in real life. And I make it a bit of a mission that any time I visit a new city, I try and check out the museums there to contextualize my learning and my journey of that new city a little bit. And I always come back with a little nugget or sort of blown away by what I've learned. So Laura is going to be joining us as our next guest. If you're ready, Laura, then now is the time to join in and call in. I can't see her yet, so I might have to tell you a little bit more about my experiences working in museums. But hopefully she'll get on with us a little bit later. Otherwise, might have to finish the show a bit early. So when I was in on maternity leave, I did meet Laura. Oh, there she is now. I did meet Laura, and she took me around the Museum of London, which I hadn't actually discovered until I had my first child. Good morning, Laura. Can you hear us all right?
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Good morning, I can. And so, Laura, I didn't realise when we were chatting that we have actually met before, haven't we?
We have, yeah. We met a few years ago, and you really helped me look at the galleries, particularly our Victorian Walk Gallery in our Museum of London, which is like a recreated Victorian street with some real and some facade street fronts. And you really helped me look at it from through your eyes as an English teacher, which I'm incredibly grateful for.
Yes, and if you haven't been to Museum London or the Docklands Museum, what Laura's referring to is they have these two sort of almost film sets of Victorian streets, and the one in the Museum of London is just the perfect setup for A Christmas Carol. I almost wanted you to do a sort of theatre in the round or a live immersive performance there of A Christmas Carol, and the Docklands is just absolutely perfect for Great Expectations, or that scene from Jekyll and Hyde where the old man is bashed to death in the moonlight. It's so evocative of some of the settings that we read about in our 19th century novels with students. So thank you for joining us today, Laura. Do you want to tell us, just start off by telling us a little bit more about your role as the learning manager at the Museum of London?
Yes, so I lead a team of amazing learning managers and learning coordinators that work across the Museum of London, the Museum of London Docklands, and we're also working on a new museum project as well, because our main site at the Museum of London is moving to a new site in West Smithfield. So we've got these three museums we kind of manage on a day-to-day basis. We work across schools and family programming, and we work on site, so we are welcoming visitors in, or we will be from May 19th. We work online, so we're looking at engaging schools and families online, and sometimes we go out to schools and families as well, so family communities and into schools. Mm-hmm. We used to deliver a huge assembly programme, but that's now changed since schools have been back, so we've reduced that to kind of more classroom-based experiences for schools. And currently we're working on relaunching our programming ready for the museum's opening at the end of May.
Well, it's so good to hear actually that you've still been able to get out into classrooms. Is that what you mean, whilst the museums have been closed?
Yeah, so we had two core programmings. So we went out into classrooms delivering storytelling around those key curriculum areas that relate to our collections. So the Great Fire of London is a really big topic for us, as is prehistory, so the Bronze Age, Iron Age and Stone Age, and the votes for women, so stories around suffragettes. And we were sending out storytelling to schools. It was a very experimental basis, and it was totally COVID compliant, but it was for us a testing of our relationships with schools and what schools were willing to have back into school at that time. So we tested that in autumn term 2020, and then we took a pause while these schools closed, and we're just getting ready to relaunch a program again.
Amazing. It's incredible how creative, I suppose, everybody has had to be in terms of the way that they're using resources and the way that they're approaching their jobs and our education system over the last year. So how has the lockdown impacted the work that you do with schools? You've obviously talked about that creative solution there, but presumably it hasn't all been completely rosy.
No, it wasn't. So when we were all sent to work from home, we paused most of our work and kind of reevaluated what could go ahead. And then unfortunately, lots of our learning team were furloughed over last year. So we really reduced the amount that we offer, but we were able to pick like a couple of key projects. And what was amazing is the Museum of London took a stance of, we are experimenting, we're going to give everything a go, but if it fails and if it doesn't work, we don't have to do it again. And what we discovered is some things worked really well, needed a bit of tweaking, and other things didn't work so well. So we hosted on Facebook a Great Fire of London live stream. It was filmed of one of the old exhibitions we had, Fire Fire. So there were some filming parts, there were some interactive parts, and that was aimed at parents who were homeschooling and aimed at
the schools that did have students in. So that went really well. It was a series of three different live streams. And the first one was really popular, but the second two weren't so popular. So that was, for us, was a great way of experimenting how we could interact with the primary students that were at home during lockdown and the primary students that were at schools. And we also tried to work with secondary students as well. So we transformed our work experience program and put it online. And so we did a online work experience program in July last year. And we consulted secondary school students as well. While they were working from home, we could give them different projects to help us with our thinking. So we had already started refreshing and re-looking at our Black History programming. But with the Black Lives Matter movement last year, we were able to talk to students about how they felt about that as well. So we've used that information in our programming, and they've helped us with some new museum planning, particularly around votes for women. So they were a really amazing. It let us work so experimentally that we could try different things.
Amazing. And so when we had our period of opening sort of in the autumn term, because I know I got back to the museums and booked my ticket, and very selfishly, it was actually rather lovely to have a timed ticket and have a much quieter museum than you normally would have, especially in the holiday times. Were you able to invite schools groups back during that time, or was that strictly for sort of civilian members of the public?
Yeah, it's a difficult one, and one we're still kind of negotiating at the moment. So the museum has reduced its opening hours, so it now opens Wednesdays to Sunday, with potential of school groups coming in Wednesday to Friday, but they need to follow the one-way system. They have to understand that there'll be other visitors around, so they would need to make sure their students were in smaller groups and that they didn't touch things. But on the Tuesdays, we've been trialling having schools days. So it's just for schools. It's a reduced number of schools. So if you imagine when we were back at our peak at our London Wall site, we could have 21 classes across the site in one day. So it was a huge amount of schools there. And we've reduced that right down to about 6 schools in a day for our schools days. So it's a much different experience that the schools are receiving if they do choose to book onto our schools days. So we trialled those in the autumn term, and we had one at the Museum of London and one at the Museum of London Docklands. And we're going to be trying those again. So if you do have any teachers listening that are interested, we're launching our summer term programme next week. So if you want to find out, you can join our teachers network, which is museumoflondon.org.uk/schools/teachers-network. And you'll be the first to hear about when our schools days are for summer term two.
I was just about very nicely placed there. I was just about to ask how teachers could get into contact with you to learn more about both your online offer, the classroom work that you've talked about, if you are going to launch that again in the spring, but also Schools Tuesday sounds like a very sensible idea. It's almost like when the swimming pools close for the swimming lessons, and you know if we just get used to that routine, if we don't visit the swimming pool on that day. And I suppose for a lot of people, it's the weekends that they want the museums open to the public, don't they? Because actually people are busy during the week and working, though Tuesday is my non-school day. So if I want to pop in, I might have to come and pop in and volunteer and help you to direct people around the one-way system. Is there anything else that you think actually this has been a really positive experience from lockdown that we want to move forwards with in the work that we're doing with schools?
Yeah, I would say the one thing that we've really worked on is what we're calling online sessions, and these are specifically for secondary schools. So we found that live streams where we broadcast out to primary schools and we could reach lots and lots of primary schools across the country was really great, because we just picked the afternoon. We knew all primary schools finished lunch, and then they most do a topic based in the afternoon, and that worked really well. But we really struggled with how we engage secondary schools in the same way, those schools that aren't in London, and how can we kind of communicate with them. So we got to try what we've been calling online sessions. So we choose the online platform that is most appropriate for the school. We choose the time that suits into their lessons, and we can broadcast to the school an interactive session, which they wouldn't otherwise have. So we've been testing this with our Generation Windrush session, where our facilitator Shango talks about his life story of moving across from Trinidad in the 1960s, and he came across on the SS Scania. So that's the first one we've transported into this online style. And it's worked really well because we've given secondary schools complete flexibility about when in their timetable they would like these sessions, which has meant that we've got a much better engagement, and that we've found that teachers are much more willing to sort out those techie bits on their side that make it an interactive session. So putting a webcam in the classroom so we can see the students based on your school's safeguarding policy and the risk assessment we've written, and based on how we can communicate with the students, whether that's via a microphone or via the teacher. And we've found secondary school teachers to be absolutely brilliant at how flexible they are and helping us to develop this new approach, which is flexible for secondary schools, but still helps us to bring our sessions and our stories and our collection to the school in a way where they might not want to leave the classroom at this moment in time.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I know from my own experience of planning lessons, there's lots of videos on YouTube, there's lots of videos on BBC Bite Size, and especially since we've been in lockdown, there is a lot of online content available there. But actually, some of the, you know, the artifacts that you have at the museum is that's where they are, and nobody else really has their hands on them. And also how tailored it is to the specific curriculum that we're studying. So often I will be looking for something online, a video or a documentary, to exemplify a contextual point, for example, but they're not necessarily going to link it back to witchcraft in Macbeth or medicine during, you know, the 19th century in the way that I want my students to understand in order to make those connections with the text. So I imagine that something so specific and so tailored is really perfect for secondary, especially sort of, well, I suppose across all the humanities and all the English subjects. So, and is that the same link where teachers can find out about that? Can you give that link to us again?
Oh, it is. Oh, I've changed. So it's museumoflondon.org.uk/schools/teachers-network. So if you join our teachers network, which is like a free e-newsletter which we send out every half term, we're sending out one next week with our summer term offer. But more importantly for us and for any teachers that are thinking about towards autumn term and what they want to do, towards the start of July, we'll be sending out a questionnaire to find out what teachers want from museums for the next academic year. We know some schools will still be quite risk averse. We know that some are ready for trips already and ready for us to come in, but we think the appetite will have changed with what all teachers really, how they want to use the Museum of London. So we would really like your feedback. So if you do join that, we'll be sending out a questionnaire soon. And it's something we did all the way through being in lockdown as well, is we continually went back to our teachers and asked what they wanted from the museum, because we didn't want to add to your workload. We wanted to complement it and make it easier. And we found the best way is just to ask.
Brilliant. So thank you so much for joining us today, Laura. And obviously Laura is at the Museum of London, but I imagine that a lot of the museums across the country are doing similar things. So I'm connecting with your local museum to see what their offer is, in the same way that Laura has described with the Teacher Network for Museum of London today. I hope you have a lovely and productive rest of the day, Laura, and thank you again for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So we've heard from a variety of educators this morning talking about different ways that they are facilitating learning outside of the classroom. And we started off very sort of outdoors, mud-based, with Sarah Watkins talking about her forest school at her own setting and general forest school principles for reception age students. We heard from Glenda over in Wales talking about her outdoor education course and her outdoor education leaders course. And then we've just heard there from Laura Turnage at the Museum of London talking about taking learning outside of the classroom and into the museum setting, or as we've seen during lockdown, trying to get the museums back into the classroom when we haven't been able to get students out and about as much as we would like to. So thank you for joining me and my guest today on Teachers Talk Radio. You can listen to this show later via the Podbean app or on Spotify if you didn't catch us live this morning. And if you search and follow Teachers Talk Radio on the Podbean app, then you can keep up to date with all of our shows, including our Tuesday morning break with me, Emma Shepherd. My personal handle on Twitter, if you want to tag me into any comments later, is @maternitycpd. And the Teachers Talk Radio hashtag is TTRadio, @TTRadio 2021. We'll be back next week for our morning break on every Tuesday between 9 to 10 a.m. And we'll be talking next week to a variety of teachers who are all teaching in the art subject, telling us about why the art subject are so important to the curriculum.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.